ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Now, Geraldine, if you cast your eye around the world right now, all the political leaders available to you, who's your dream dinner party guest list?
Look, at the moment, it's Mark Carney.
Oh, you liked that speech this
did.
Week, didn't you? What about Xi Jinping or Trump or Putin? I'd love to at least know them.
Well, look, you might be surprised. I would not mind meeting Keir Starmer, even though I know you're going to say...
He's boring.
He's boring. I knew you were going to say that. I think there's more to him than meets the eye, but he's certainly not revealing that to the British people at the moment.
Yeah, he's in trouble. And on the sidelines, Nigel Farage. Growing in popularity, could he be Britain's next Prime Minister?
I certainly don't want to sit around a table with him, but let's see. And we're going to exactly try to explore this particular dilemma for the Brits. I'm Geraldine Doogue.
I'm Hamish McDonald, and welcome to the Friday edition of Global Roaming.
Well, Hamish, we made it to the end of the week. Our first
gripping onto the desk, I might add.
Hanging on. Yes, it's been quite a week. I mean, quite a week in all sorts of ways, but we're here and we're delighted to be so.
And in a sense, we're talking about a nation, a people that have been really a centrepiece of the global Western-dominated order ever since World War II, the United Kingdom, and a nation that's in trouble, a people that don't really know their place in the world. Perhaps that's a symptom of the broader currents that we're observing. You know, Trump in Davos saying, oh, well, we've now got a framework for a deal on Greenland, or was it Iceland? He got lost. Macron standing up with this blistering speech, the French president, and, of course, Mark Carney, the Canadian Prime Minister, may be finding his moment in all of this. And in a way, he kind of read the funeral rites of the Western order.
Let me be direct. We are in the midst of a rupture, not a transition. The multilateral institutions on which the middle powers have relied, the WTO, the UN, the COP, the architecture, the very architecture of collective problem solving are under threat. Middle powers must act together because if we're not at the table, we're on the menu.
He did. There was a sense that Carney was settled about where he was and trying to send that message out, which I think is just a reminder again about confident leadership. There's something there that encourages others to believe that there's hope.
Now, we should say for listeners, given that we've shifted to this daily format now on Global Roaming, you're getting a lot more topics, a lot more episodes in your feed. At the end of the week, we'll try and take a step back from the stuff that's in the headlines, perhaps day in, day out. And so this week, it is the UK that we're focusing on, and both Keir Starmer's troubles, but also the rise of one Nigel Farage.
One Nigel Farage, who I would not like to have dinner with, can
Why?
I tell you that?
I mean, a lot of Britain clearly would. This
because
is
he's a hooray Henry. You know, to me, he shouts at me, but he's that sort of ha-ha big. There's a particular masculineness about him that I find very off-putting.
But there is something about it that is appealing to the British public right now.
Because at
the polls put him in front.
At the moment, they do.
Maybe it's worth for listeners a little reminder of Farage. This is back in 2016, giving a fiery and triumphant speech to the European Parliament after the Leave campaign won the Brexit referendum.
Isn't it funny? You know, when I came here 17 years ago and I said that I wanted to lead a campaign to get Britain to leave the European Union, you all laughed at me. Well, I have to say, you're not laughing now, are you? And the reason you're so angry has been perfectly clear from all the angry exchanges this morning. You, as a political project, are in denial.
So he was originally the leader of UKIP, UK Independence Party. He now leads a party called Reform. You're going to hear more about that on this episode. It's got quite a lot of big money behind it. For example, Nick Candy, who was married to Holly Candy, Holly Valance, the former Neighbours actress. They're now separated, but she's become a right-wing political figure as well. There's lots of Tory former ministers leaving the Tories to join Reform. And this party stands a pretty good chance in the forthcoming council elections, so local government elections, which take place across the UK all in on May. The one day. Shall we set up our guest?
Yes, I think we should, because we're thrilled to catch up again with Krishnan Gurumurthy while he was here in Australia. Now, Krish is a familiar voice, I think, to our regular listeners. He's an anchor of Channel 4 News, where Hamish worked. He's covered some of the biggest moments of our time, as he was telling us. I mean, Syria, Yemen, Gaza, and Iran, where he's been more than once. And
he's a pretty big deal in the UK. He did well on Strictly, the ballroom dancing show. But he's a frequent visitor to Australia. And
he's
has,
married to an Australian.
Exactly.
He? Yeah.
Here he is now. Krish, welcome back to Global Roaming, this time in person. Good to see you here in Australia.
Yeah, great to be here in the studio.
Now, Krish, I think the last time we spoke to you on Global Roaming was right before the UK election. That was back in 2024. Seems like an age ago. Will Starmer survive till the next election as leader?
Predicting British politics is a mug's game. What I can tell you is that there are definite campaigns from more than one of the leading figures in the Labour Party to challenge him. And, you know, they are active, they are organised, and so it's very, very possible that he will face a leadership challenge within months. Some people say it could even be before May. You know, British politics is full of politicians who are tearing their hair out, who don't know what to do, I think is the problem at the moment. And Labour have struggled to articulate a clear vision. They have struggled with their inheritance, which was very bad. And they are struggling to make people feel better. I think it's that feel-good factor is not just elusive, but sort of non-existent. And that is their big problem. You know, that they will point to a series of things that they have done that are incrementally good. I mean, at the moment, you know, Starmer's repeated message is all about the cost of living. And they're trying to say, look, we are doing things like helping you with your energy bills.
Things have been tough in Britain for a while. For many, life is still harder than it should be. You long for a bit more money in your pockets, a meal out, a holiday, the chance to make a special family moment extra special. In 2026, the choices we've made will mean more people will begin to feel positive change in your bills, your communities, and your health service.
But the help with the energy bills amounts, on average, if it's £150 off a bill that has gone up by hundreds and hundreds of pounds over the last few years, again, people don't really feel it as a great bonus.
Doesn't so it's that, a really that hard sound sell. Familiar?
It certainly does. I mean, there's so much here that sounds familiar, with the possible exception, like one of the things that is allegedly causing a great deal of angst is potholes.
Yeah, it always does. These are little measures by which people judge, are things getting better or worse? And if they don't feel they're getting better, they wonder, what's the point? And that is the really big fundamental problem in British politics at the moment, that there is a hollowing out of confidence in established political parties. And that's why people are considering giving people like Nigel Farage
and
this Reform Party a chance.
Well, how is Farage remodelling himself, Nigel Farage? Because apparently he is.
I mean, I think you can say Nigel Farage is trying not to frighten the horses. He is trying to appeal to mainstream conservatives now. I mean, he's done very well at winning over this slightly febrile constituency, often in northern constituencies in England, of working class voters who have been Labour in the past, voted for Boris Johnson when Boris Johnson was sort of, you know, in his popular phase, and now are going to Reform. But what Farage needs is to win over mainstream conservatives, many of whom are frightened by him and are concerned about the kind of government that he would lead and the kind of messages. You know, a lot of people have been turned off by some of the immigration messages that Reform have been pumping out. And so I think he is toning it down.
Does he give interviews?
he's kind of stopped giving interviews. You know, Farage was invented, you know, in many ways by a very high media profile. And he would do everything all the time. But he's basically stopped and he's entered a very sort of Trumpian phase of giving press conferences, at which he will take all comers, you know, and he will take questions from pretty much everyone. But a press conference, as we know, can be controlled by the person holding it. You don't have to answer the question. You can move on. Journalists can't follow up. It's very, very hard to pin somebody down. And so it's, you know, he's got the advantage in his interactions with the media. And of course, he's got his own show on GB News.
Well, I'm very pleased to be joined by the 56th Speaker of the US House of Representatives, Mike Johnson, who joins us here on GB News. Mike, welcome to our channel.
Great to be with you.
And we cover
and it's become quite popular. It's, you know, it's become in some sections the most popular continuous television news channel.
So how seriously do you take the predictions that he could form government? Because I guess when we read the papers from here, we see from time to time polls suggesting that reform is ahead of the Tories, stories about the Greens approaching the popularity stakes of the Labor Party, or maybe even a new left-wing party with Jeremy Corbyn in it. It's a different political system to what we have in terms of the voting process, and therefore the possibility of a big swing is different. How do you interpret it?
Well, obviously, we have still have a first-past-the-post system. It's a winner-takes-all system. And in Britain, if you get to a certain level, about, you know, mid-30%, you are suddenly in the driving seat and you can win a majority. If you get above that, if you get around 40%, you can have a massive majority. In the past, the problem of reform was that they were doing quite well around sort of mid-20s nationally, but that translated into very few seats. So at the general election, they only won 5 seats. But the arithmetic in Britain means that once you get up to the levels they are polling at now, you overcome
you
that
problem. You leapfrog.
And you don't just leapfrog, you landslide.
So that's the domestic picture. What about where the UK sits in the world, particularly Europe? Even, you know, I know you've been travelling to the Middle East a bit over the last year. There are much larger threats at play. And I note, for example, you know, former MI6 chief, some pretty dire warnings recently about what Britain might be facing in the years ahead, the possibility, very real possibility of conflict. You know, we're talking about NATO breaking up if Trump tries to take Greenland. How's all of that playing into what you're describing?
I mean, it's really interesting in that, you know, foreign affairs has dominated the news agenda for the last year and a half.
Hasn't that for longer because of Brexit? Brexit, in a sense, is
yes, but I mean, Brexit was 10 years ago now.
Yeah,
you know, the vote, and so the extent to which the European debate has been part of British politics has diminished. Immigration has replaced it as a big screaming issue in British politics. But with foreign affairs, you know, as everywhere, I guess, now all roads lead to Trump. And so Britain's positioning on foreign affairs has all been about how you maintain the relationship with the United States, how you can still be a close ally of a government, you know, you disagree with on all sorts of levels. And the European question has become primarily economic and also about immigration. Now, immigration is actually coming down in Britain. Net immigration has fallen dramatically from the very unpopular highs of
there were still 46,000 last year. 41,500 migrants arrived on small boats, 15%.
That's illegal immigration. So you've got to draw the distinction between legal immigration and illegal immigration. So illegal immigration is what, you know, is people arriving on small boats, and that's extremely unpopular with all political parties. They all want to tackle it. They're all struggling. Legal immigration is the thing that's reached absolutely extraordinary heights of 750,000-900,000 people in a year. And when these figures came out, they were extremely unpopular. So the European question has been partly about tackling the illegal immigration question, but now we're starting to see a different factor to it, which is about Keir Starmer's focus on the cost of living and whether closer integration with the European Union in terms of rules and regulations.
Like some sort of new customs union.
Well, I mean, customs union is a big, big move, and Keir Starmer doesn't want to go there because it would fundamentally overturn the Brexit referendum. But some Labour politicians are arguing for that.
You're listening to Global Roaming from Radio National with me, Hamish McDonald.
And me, Geraldine Doogue.
Our guest on this episode is Krishnan Gurumurthy from Britain's Channel 4 News. Stay listening, because he's got a rather surprising, frankly, a little bit trashy recommendation for you.
Can I just ask you then about Starmer's whole style? Because one of the things that, is very interesting in this is the nature of rhetoric and how much you're saying no one appears to be able to fix anything. That's really the underlying message, which is not a good message for democracy anywhere here as well. So, you know, is Starmer just lacking that need for perceived leadership style that you say Farage is working on? And before we all just say, oh, you know, that's terribly frippery, maybe people do need a bit of that.
Well, I think it depends on what you're actually doing and whether you have a plan. Remember, Starmer was never this great charismatic leader. You know, his whole sell was
decency.
I am decent. I am not like the showman Boris Johnson. Mm. I've come from a public service background. Mm. I've run the Crown Prosecution Service. I may be sort of grey by comparison, but I know how to get things done. That was his whole sell, and it would work, I think, if you were able to show that you are making things better, and people were able to feel it. The trouble is that when it's hard to convince people that their lives are getting better, that's when political rhetoric, leadership, this whole question of vision becomes a little bit more salient.
But that is your job then. Your job is to work with the existing circumstances, isn't it?
Yes. Arguably your job, the job is to make Britain better and therefore neutralise this whole question of personality. But if you're unable to do that, then, and that's why we're seeing talk of leadership challenge, then it is about leadership articulating a vision, showing people what this is about, taking on the opposition. So yeah, I mean, there's no doubt that Starmer is grey by comparison to Nigel Farage or Boris Johnson or the Green leader. Now, but that was his selling point.
That was
to some degree.
To stop the chaos.
He's never going to transform into a charismatic, cuddly, likable guy who you want to go down the pub with. His only sell is, can I actually deliver what I said I was going to do? And whether the British people will give him the time to do that is the big question, because the electorate have become incredibly impatient. I think like a lot of places around the world, people are not giving governments a lot of time. So that's why you see these astonishing popularity opinion polls showing Starmer as the most unpopular Prime Minister in living memory. And you kind of think, well, what's he done wrong? In comparison to previous governments? It's not, and it's not really about that. It is about the, febrility, if that's a word, of the British electorate.
Krish, I did earlier in the our pre-chat talk about the analogy with the English cricket team that has just come through Australia and the current state of the UK.
Do we have
UK.
To talk about
my point being that there was this awful moment. I actually don't think Australians enjoyed seeing the Brits humbled the way. I don't actually think the majority. I think they wanted more of a contest.
Yes, it just got good at the end.
But the point is, it did. Somebody once, I saw James Glenday on our breakfast program just say to some commentators, are they just not good enough at the moment? Are they just not good enough at the moment? It was, a simple question, humble and honest.
Yeah.
And the commentator said, no, I don't think they are. And we, our team wasn't all that great either in many ways. So is that, what is this a sort of a stage that the UK is going through that it has to sort of reassemble its talents? It has to rethink. It has to sort of reprioritise people, the Ben Stokes of this world, so there are more of them. I just feel there's something.
Do you mean more broadly?
In general? I'm not talking about cricket.
Maybe. I wonder whether we are just in a different phase and you cannot recapture you know, days when things were simple and tribal. British politics is fragmented. We're no longer a two-party system. We're now a five-party system. That's going to have fundamental differences come the next election. We might be looking at coalition governments. We might be looking at electoral reform. The idea of a country swinging behind political leadership and it remaining popular at the moment seems a long, long way off. I don't know whether we'll ever recapture that kind of moment.
Unless there's a war.
Well, I mean, wars certainly will unify to some degree if it's a war that people agree on. And the idea of there being a war that Britain would agree on right now is also not that easy. I mean, you know, yes, you know, the whole question of us being in a hybrid war, as government ministers now talk about with Russia, might potentially be a unifying influence on the country. But I don't think even that is straightforward. You know, the fragmentation of politics also means that there will be different messages. There, you know, the left have a very different approach to how we should be dealing with this and thinking about this. And I think even this period, because the cost of living is such a problem, because public services are in such a mess, telling people we now have to prioritise defence and massively increase defence spending is also a hard political sell. You know, on a patriotic level, on a threat level, yes, you know, politicians from all parties can make those arguments. But when it comes down to paying the bills, These are difficult things to sell to voters.
Sir Alex Younger, the former MI6 chief, I think it was just last week, said, you know, this line about if you don't have a sphere of influence, you're in someone else's.
Yes.
I mean, is there seriously some thought to a British sphere of influence? Like, you know, the empire is very much in the rearview mirror, isn't it?
I don't think so. I mean, you know, British foreign policy has been so... I mean, the trouble, as I say, is Britain's relationship with America. You know, Britain's foreign policy has essentially been set by America to a large degree for many, many years when it comes, you know, outside Europe. And that is becoming harder and harder to square. And so we are seeing the beginning of debate around to what extent Britain should diverge from the American line on things. And obviously Greenland is, you know, could be a huge test because it really divides British loyalties. Does Britain go with the European line or the American line when it comes to this quite fundamental question? So, no, I think Britain sees itself as perhaps, or the British government sees itself as perhaps trying to recapture an old model of British diplomacy being very important. You know, of Britain being the bridge. Mm. And Britain was always the bridge between Washington and Europe, but that bridge is much more important now because the rivalry is open. You know, the United States has an open stated foreign policy goal of encouraging the overthrow of social democratic governments in Europe. It has a policy now of trying to take Greenland. And that means that Britain as the interlocutor, as the diplomat that tries to resolve these issues, arguably becomes more important than ever. And I think that's where British politicians perhaps see the sphere of influence, if you like.
We often ask our guests for a recommendation, something to read or listen to or watch. You've just enjoyed a lovely break here in Australia. What have you read?
Oh, gosh, that's a terrible question. I've been very, very lazy on my reading. I do a podcast called Ways to Change the World in Britain, which involves me usually reading two books a week.
Oh, yeah. So you're on a break.
I have to admit, I've been watching trash TV
like
on Netflix. I've been binging this terrible series. I mean, it's not terrible; it's great, but it's quite old. Called Younger,
okay,
which is basically sort of an update on Sex and the City, created by the same guy, and it's total nonsense, but very enjoyable on holiday. My approach to holiday is not take a load of meaty books and go away because I spend my life reading meaty books. It's switch off, do all the guilty pleasures.
And you're back into it. Are you back into
and
it?
So I'm afraid I have no intellectual recommendations from my holiday.
Oh, well. He's off to Japan tomorrow.
I am off to Japan tomorrow filming.
Back into the big books.
And sending the family home. So this is my sort of re-entry into work after 3 weeks off.
Chris, thank you.
It's been wonderful to chat.
Thank you very much.
Well, notwithstanding that recommendation, Hamish, I must say I was really thinking as we were talking, I wonder what Churchill would have made of potholes or Lord Palmerston, you know, that becomes the smallness of a lot of British anxieties and obsessions at the moment, the British aspirations seem so small. I reckon that's playing quite a role in their general sort of ennui.
So, recommendations, Geraldine. Are you going to go down the trash route?
No, I went and saw and totally commend My Brother's Band that's on at the moment in the
cinemas.
It's a beautiful French film about a man who discovers that he was actually adopted and he's very, very ill with leukemia. He has to get a transfusion from a family member and he has to find his natural brother. And the brother lives in a very different portion of France. And it suddenly made me realise, you know, because I think France often looks like a bit of a basket case, but a culture that can produce such a good film, full of hope, can't be in altogether bad shape. I thoroughly recommend it.
I'm excited about our recommendations because I've accrued so many great ones from over the summer. I've been doing some wonderful reading and watching and listening. But my recommendation on the TV binging theme from Krishnan is Tehran. Have you seen Tehran?
No, I haven't. Not.
So it's on Apple TV. It's from the makers of Fauda, the Israeli TV production. This is about a female Mossad agent who goes into Tehran on a particular mission and essentially gets stuck there. And it's entering the third season. It is absolutely captivating. What I think is really fascinating about it is that it doesn't necessarily, even though it's an Israeli production, it doesn't necessarily try to paint either the Iranian or the Israeli side as morally superior. It shows them both at their worst and their best in terms of the Revolutionary Guards, counterintelligence, as well as the Mossad agents. It's an extraordinary series.
Wow. Okay. I haven't heard about that, so I will take that up.
Global.roaming@abc.net.au is our email address. Don't forget our Monday episode. We're going to be using a lot more of your top class, first-rate feedback and questions and ideas to drive the program. So keep it coming and we'll look forward to seeing you on Monday.
Oh, it's just our mailbag just astonishes me. Thanks to our producers, Shane Anderson and Carly Morris. And before we go, Hamish, we have something rather important. We are losing our fabulous producer, Taryn Priyadko, to a new baby who is due in 3 weeks, I think.
We are going to have our first baby Roma, which we're very excited about. Taryn, you've been here from the beginning. You've driven us, you've worked us, you've disciplined Geraldine and me time and time and time again. So thank you very much for that. We love you very much and we can't wait to meet the new edition.
This baby has been privy to some extraordinary conversations in the last little while, so I think the baby will be studying sort of international relations by the time it's four.
See you next time.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.